Hello everyone, welcome to the Local Shop Podcast. I'm Chris Noyce and this is the podcast for everything to do with the convenience sector and the issues facing local shops. Now on this episode I'm joined by ACS Head of Public Affairs Ed Woodall.
Hello.
And ACS Chief Executive James Lohman.
Hello.
To try and make sense of some of the manifesto commitments that have been made by all of the parties over the last couple of weeks, with of course a particular focus on the issues that affect our sector. Now, you've both been through a few election campaigns now, and that doesn't even go back that far. That's just a couple of years we've had a few.
Annual election campaigns.
Yeah. So I guess compared to previous manifesto runs, how do you think this round stacks up? Are the parties being ambitious enough, or are they playing a bit safe?
Well, we've got two very different sets of manifestos from the Conservatives and Labour Party in particular in terms of spending commitments. I mean, Labour has sort of doubled down on its previous manifesto and seeking to spend more and really fundamentally change how the British economy would work in the future. So in that sense, they're being very ambitious. I think it's £82 billion worth of spending. And obviously a change in format, into a lot more state ownership and all those things. The Conservatives, on the other hand, have intentionally played it very safe with their manifesto. And I think that's partly because of lessons that they learned from 2017, which was, you know, don't talk about social care and put very complex policies in there. So actually it's quite light on detail and it's quite light on spending. I think it's £2.9 billion, which isn't small amounts of money, but it's, you know, in comparison to the other ones on the table, it's much smaller.
And generally, you'd think Conservatives would be playing it safe on all sorts of issues because they're leading in the polls. So they're, you know, it's don't do anything wrong rather than try and, you know, make waves on things.
Yeah, I think we learned a lesson from last time as well when they made a number of quite substantive proposals in the 2017 manifesto, some of which, notably the social care plan, really tripped them up and had a big impact. So I think they're making sure it doesn't happen. Labour probably believes it's learned its lesson by there was a lot in its 2017 manifesto, and there's even more in this manifesto. You know, so they're trying to win on, you know, lots of policies to appeal to different groups and to talk about the detail of how they would govern. And what's interesting about manifestos generally is, you know, what is actually the role of a manifesto, and going back to the traditional view that this is your contract with the electorate. So you said before they go into the ballot box, this is what we will do. Therefore, you're elected to government. That's therefore what you do. I think at all times that's been a slightly flawed idea. It's not quite as straightforward as that. But I think particularly in this age of, you know, coalitions and of the natural alignments in politics not being along two main party lines.
Yeah.
But, you know, people, one thing we always say is that people are now probably more aligned to being Leave or Remain than they are to being Conservative or Labour. Well, certainly that's as much of a factor. So I think in these days, I'm not sure that old view of how manifestos work is quite there. Nonetheless, why it's important to us is if the government brings in a measure in its when it's in government, which has been in its manifesto, it has a real, feel like, electoral. It has mandates to do that. That's precisely it. So it's very hard to stop a government introducing something and persuade one of their MPs not to vote for something that's been in their manifesto. So it is really relevant why we follow them. But I think that whole idea of a set of concrete commitments, like it was like a business plan, I think is probably not the case anymore.
Yeah, sure. And a slightly nerdy thing that I've learned this, it might be wrong, about manifestos and how it pertains to the Lords. And it's something, if something's in a manifesto, it won't be...
Any financial commitment, the Lords won't block, and equally anything in a manifesto is sort of generally a principle, on principle they won't block, is the general rule.
Yeah, as ever, elected chamber, yeah.
But as we've seen from parliamentary activity recently, everything's
off the grabs. Yeah,
sort of gentleman's agreement of the British unwritten British constitution get thrown out the window very quickly when things go wrong.
Yeah, speaking about throwing agreements out the window, let's get down to the issues. And first things first, it's Brexit, and we probably should get a klaxon at some point. It's been pretty well publicised that Conservatives want to get Brexit done as soon as possible. Liberal Democrats want to revoke Article 50 as soon as possible, and the Labour Party are in the middle, want to put both options basically to the people in a second referendum. Now, in recent months, retailers have told us that essentially prolonging uncertainty is probably the thing that does the most damage. So, Ed, can you bring some clarity to the timelines on Brexit for how the parties see it and what actually is going on here?
Yeah, so the Conservatives are going to have to bring forward quite quickly, probably very early in the new year, they're getting the withdrawal agreement through the House of Commons and get that done, because essentially they've got 12 months then to December 2020 to get a free trade agreement agreed with the European Union.
Yeah.
And they have a commitment again for a hard deadline in their manifesto that says they will not extend the implementation period beyond December 2020. So that means that potentially we come to another hard deadline at the end of 2020 if they haven't got that free trade agreement in there, because obviously it was a manifesto commitment.
And are these deadlines harder or softer than the previous hard deadlines that we've had?
Well, exactly. That's the challenge. There's a lot of ambiguity around these. But, you know, they're, what we're going to be sure of is there will be some pretty hard, you know, focused minds in number 10 about delivering Brexit as their one and only thing that they have to do. And that's relevant for all the other policy agendas, because I think we won't see that much else happen in reality. Big things that we like to see happen, like business rates reviews and everything that we'll come on to, they're going to be a big challenge for a party to deliver that are trying to deliver a free trade agreement in less than 12 months. So that's going to be tough.
Yeah, so just parliamentary time is going to be a nightmare.
Yeah. Especially the commitment to striking other deals as well. So the benefits that's being put forward of Brexit is what be able to strike better deals with countries around the world. And they're setting themselves deadlines of how they want to do that very quickly. And so that's going to be the priority, isn't it? It's going to be the deal with the EU and then deal with other places so that they can, well, certainly by the next election, they can say, look, this is why this was a better course of action to take.
And I think of all the issues we're going to talk about, this is the one that gets affected most by the potential of a hung parliament. So, James, if that were to happen, where can you see alliances forming to get something through?
I think it's not quite as simple as what I'm about to say, but I think essentially if there is a Conservative majority, then we are, it will unfold, as Ed said. I think if there is if there's a majority of other parties pretty much combined, and the reason why it's a bit more complicated is Sinn Féin won't take their seats in Parliament. The DUP, while I'd be surprised if they back the current Boris Johnson negotiated deal, are also unlikely to back a second referendum. So it's not quite straightforward. Essentially, if the number of Conservative MPs is more than the number of all the other maybe mainland GB party MPs, then we're probably heading, as Ed laid out, if it's the other way round and the other parties outweigh the Conservatives, we are probably heading towards some form of second referendum. And, you know, on the basis of a deal negotiated by that government, which could be quite a complex multi-party government, versus Remain, and that would probably be the route by which it went down.
And so you think second referendum rather than very quick turnaround for another general election?
It's possible the latter. I mean, it just seems to me that in a sense, what would be different with another general election at that time, and also you are getting them very squeezed. It'd be very, very difficult. I mean, we've been used to very sort of tight move deadlines in recent years, but if there were another general election and the Conservatives went in again and said there'll be no extension, well, then they're into a very short period of time to negotiate and deal with the EU and to make progress with deals with everyone else. So I would have thought it's either second referendum or leaving on the Boris Johnson deal. But as we learned, it's usually the third option that no one thinks about that's the one that's going to happen. And it is possible we end up with a different outcome.
Okay, good. Well, all right, we've got Brexit done.
That's
again.
Let's get Brexit done.
So let's get on to domestic policy now. And the first issue that I want to look at is crime. This, of course, has been one of the biggest issues for retailers for a long time. And it's fair to say something that's been a significant part of the campaigns for most of the parties. Ed, which of the headline announcements on tackling crime stand out to you?
Well, I suppose it's unavoidable to see all of the policing commitments. Yep. I mean, Boris Johnson's been making cups of tea in front of signs that say, you know,
I mean, 20, haven't
000,
we all?
Yeah, haven't we all, indeed. But 20,000 more police officers, Labour Party are making similar commitments but slightly higher, Liberal Democrats are looking to invest £1 billion in
policing. Yeah, so the Labour commitment is literally whatever the Conservatives say, we'll just do 2,000 more than that.
Yes, it is. So, good. You know, and it shows, and that shows how much the parties see that policing and justice is a core issue in this election and will be a core issue in the next parliament and a big focus. And, you know, that's positive for us because we're as a sector, we have some big challenges, which we all know and are well rehearsed. I suppose I say those policing things are very good, but what I'm most pleased with is that they're looking at reforms to the justice system that look at tackling this a bit deeper. There's lots of commitments around tackling drug-related crime. There's lots of commitments around more investment in the justice system, because we know from talking to retailers that it's about repeat offenders that come back in, that are known to the police, that are known to them, and those people aren't getting the help they need. So I think that's the positive space that we're in with the crime and justice agenda.
And some reasonably fundamental changes proposed by people like Liberal Democrats, getting rid of police and crime commissioners instead of that having boards made up of local councillors. Do we need that level of fundamental change, or is it more just tweaks around the numbers?
Well, I mean, fundamental change in policing is obviously a choice. It was a big Conservative policy. I don't think it actually fundamentally changes the way that policing priorities are
sure,
set. It's
of
just
course, yeah.
not
it's just who
got
ends
a big
up being
structure in
yeah.
someone that's politically identifiable with it individually. But, you know, it's right that they're focusing on these on this area.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I'm not a fan of the Police and Crime Commissioner system. I think that this very much American idea of, you know, all the public servants are, and they're all elected, there's that sort of... The reality is turnout in Police and Crime Commissioner elections is so low.
Mm.
I don't really believe in that. That democratic accountability works quite as it's set out. However, if there are PCC elections again, which are proposed for middle of next year, because there's low turnout, what that shows is if you turn out as a retailer and vote in those elections, you can have more impact. So,
yeah.
you know, whatever system they run, we've got to try and influence that.
And of course, in the Conservative manifesto, and we're assuming that at the moment in the polls, they're favourites to win. They're talking about, you know, devolution agenda, more powers to police and crime commissioners. So, you know,
even more important,
probably, yeah, more important to engage with them. So next up, we have the environment, and this has become such a big issue in this election campaign that we've just had an entire leaders' debate dedicated to the topic, which has generated its own controversies, which we'll not go into.
It's an ice sculpture at the moment. It's sitting on this chair.
Yes, Ed doing a very good impression of James. So James, definitely James, not an ice sculpture. How do the parties line up on the environment, specifically on issues like tackling plastic waste? And do you think that what they're doing, what they're proposing, do you think that's the right direction for them to be going?
I actually think, yes, it is the right direction. I think there needs to be more intervention and more public policy around plastic, around waste generally, actually. I mean, we're very careful that we often shorthand this to talk about also about plastics. It's about carbon. But these things are it's more much more complex issue. But I actually think the direction of travel is right on this. It's the detail that's the issue.
Yeah.
And this is what really worries me. And, you know, everyone's basically saying, yeah, we'll just use a deposit return scheme. SNP are already doing it in Scotland.
Sure.
And I understand why that happens. I've got some real practical concerns about deposit return scheme. And if there's one thing that probably has frustrated us, is the lack of real engagement on that detail, which is what it's all about.
And there's a lack of engagement in the manifestos, isn't there? Because they just say deposit return scheme.
Exactly.
I mean, these things
are just a tick box. Like, just, you know, and I think that, yeah, that we know there are good and bad deposit return schemes. And our concern about the way the debate is going is that we're heading towards some bad deposit return schemes, specifically including all product, all types of packaging in that, massively increases the burdens and the challenges in operating those systems. And actually, it's not very well targeted because, you know, I always think, take it out the abstract, most people recycle most of the products they consume at home in curbside collection.
Yeah.
That can be improved, must be improved, but that is not really the problem. The problem is on the go, a lot of which is bought from our member stores. So focusing on those smaller containers is the most effective targeted way of filling the gap between our recycling rates and some of our European neighbours. And I think it's absolutely right to be looking at that and also to look at other things. And, you know, I think one policy which the previous government, I guess we now call it, before, you know, the Conservative government up to now, has been pushing, which we think is broadly a good idea, is changing the whole producer responsibility system.
Yep.
So that rather than a system which is based around everyone doing lots of measurement and bureaucracy and calculation and then paying some money into what is actually quite an abstract, feels like a tax to those retailers, this can apply costs, this is the true costs, the true social and environmental costs of those products. It can apply those throughout the supply chain of those products so that everyone, manufacturers, wholesalers, retailers, consumers, are seeing and paying the cost of those materials. And I think that is the right direction to travel as well.
Yeah, and it seems like the parties are pretty much aligned on most of these issues as well.
Yeah, there's core consensus around the key issues around deposit return scheme. As you say, it's rather light on detail, and we need to sort of drill down to that quickly. But the Conservatives are committed to include glass in their DRS scheme. That's about as much detail as we got, but obviously that's still a brilliant outcome.
Yeah, and of course the danger of all this, as we talked earlier about Brexit and parliamentary time, is that with such a huge issue that is a massive investment, if it's not given proper parliamentary time and this stuff gets rushed through, then... You know, so it's a big risk to take if it's not thought through
Absolutely.
Properly.
We see in Scotland so many decisions are, oh, that's for the scheme administrator. The scheme administrator will set and sort that. Well, that's quite risky. You've got to, you know, we don't know what that scheme administrator is going to be. And with no real democratic route into influence and discuss and hold into account, I mean, that really does worry me.
Yeah. Now, as a sector that employs around 405,000 people, we are watching very closely when the main parties talk in the manifestos about wage rates and other employment benefits. Ed, are wage rates still being used as a bargaining chip by the leaders?
Well, it's certainly been a prominent part of everyone's campaign, and there's a little bit of one-upmanship going on again between the parties around this. So the national living wage has been politicised in this election and used to appeal to each of the parties' base, and that's a shame because the success of that policy has always been that the Low Pay Commission has objectively analysed the information and then come forward with recommendations of what deemed the economy can sustain, and that's broadly the sort of the train of thought across the developed world, that those objectivity is key to that. So it's unfortunate that we're doing that, but all the evidence suggests there is some headroom for it to go up, but it's about the pace at which that happens.
Yeah.
So Labour are proposing for it to go up immediately to a real living wage for anyone from above 16 straight away. The Conservatives are proposing it goes up to £10.50 on a trajectory towards 2024. But both of those are actually incredibly ambitious internationally. There wouldn't be a developed sort of G7 country at the same pace as that. And that's where the challenge is. That's where we start to go into unknown territory about what the actual impact is on the labour market. So it's important that we obviously stay close and reflect on what those impacts could be.
Yeah, and James, the manifestos talk pretty much broadly about productivity and increasing productivity. That's not necessarily straightforward in our sector, is it?
No, exactly. I think if you're in manufacturing industries and these sort of big scale distributors like Amazon and people like that, you're constantly trying to tweak that, how much labour can be actually carried out by machines, and mm-hmm. that's the making those decisions to shift that by 1 or 2% makes a huge difference. In stores, it's much blunter than that. You've either got 1, 2, 3, or 4 people there. The changes that you're making, quite significant changes in every shift. The amount of people there, and obviously as much as possible, you don't want to have one person in the store. You want to have at least 1-on-1, 2 people in total in the store. So yeah, and yes, there are things you can do to improve productivity, and so, like, for example, self checkouts and so on. But some of that comes at a cost, and I think that it actually reduces the value that we generate as a sector if we're not careful. So yeah. And I think all those the frustration I sometimes have about this is that retailers are looking to do those things anyway where it makes sense for their business. It makes perfect business. Being more productive isn't some sort of government objective we're altruistically trying to comply with. That everything you do in a business is try and become more productive because that's how you make money.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Retailers are always looking for efficiencies everywhere.
Absolutely, and whether living wage is going up or not, people are looking to do that. So, yeah, I find that debate a little bit frustrating. And I suppose, fundamentally, what we see is this is the biggest financial and business issue facing our sector. And all the parties really are aligned on saying we're going to keep pushing up these costs, some quicker than others, some in slightly different ways, but essentially everyone has accepted that's something they want to do. And there are real consequences for our sector and many other sectors as well. And it's ironic we talk about some of the challenges on the high street. Well, then we might talk about business rates in a second, but that's obviously a really important issue and the impact of online, etc. But when I talk to retailers, not just in our sector, but on high streets, The increase in wage costs is the biggest single factor that's put them under pressure.
Absolutely.
I think sometimes we don't recognise the full consequences of the way this debate has been ratcheted up, and that's I think that's quite dangerous.
Yeah, and you mentioned business rates. You're absolutely right. That's where I'm going next, and it's one of the areas where the parties are being forced to get a bit creative this time around. We've seen lots of different things, lots of different proposals on business rates, and there's been a lot of pressure to look at business rates reform from us and others. Ed, realistically, how much can be done to change the business rate system, given that we've heard so many times that it is basically a zero-sum game? And if there is change, is that necessarily a good thing for retailers?
So there's lots that can be done to reform the existing system to make it better, which we have made very clear to the government that we want to try and work within existing property taxes, but try and make it better so that people are incentivized to invest instead of being penalized for extending or increasing the offer in their store, so it can definitely be improved. I think the commitment around fundamental reviews and new options like land value tax are acknowledging the fact that the economy is changing. The way that property is used is used more efficiently is changing. Therefore, the business rate system needs to change with that as well. But what we haven't quite got to is some consensus and real clarity around where that goes next.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that what's clear is you need to break this rule around fiscal neutrality that it raises the same amount every year, and actually you need to expand the overall tax base so you can offset what business rates is currently doing. Because if you don't, it's going to keep putting on a lot of pressure on a lot smaller base of people that are paying the tax.
Yeah, and I was a bit confused by this idea of a land value tax, given that one of the big, I guess, underpayers is online businesses. It feels like it doesn't necessarily address that.
Mm. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, in a sense, in a way, the land value tax, this whole idea of making it much more about purely about the value of that land rather than the business or how it's been developed. On one hand, it's quite not a bad idea for us, because often we operate in secondary areas where land values will be slightly less.
Yeah.
And also, one of our main points here is, if you, exactly as Ed said, if you improve your business and invest and develop, you shouldn't be charged more. It's actually the system at the moment says you make those investments and then your business rates go up as a result of that. So there's something to be said for that, but you know, fundamentally, is it is that something that's going to alleviate this real difference, this very unlevel playing field between online businesses and bricks and mortar? I don't think a land value tax would achieve that.
Mm. And interesting to note, I don't think I saw anywhere in the manifesto is anyone talking about sales tax in place of business rates. I think people coming to terms with the fact that that's probably a bad idea and will hit smallest businesses hardest.
Certainly a general sales tax. I mean, we'd be very opposed. We're a low margin business. I mean, if you had to pay a tax of, you know, a couple of percent on your PayPoint transactions and post office business and so on, I mean, it obviously can possibly make sense for that business.
Yeah,
so
sure.
And indeed, for, you know, we're a generally low margin business. I think Local Shop Report this year said typical margin is between 20% and 28%. There are other sectors trading with similar properties with 60-70% gross margin. So the impact on us would be far, far greater if it was based on something based on sales. But where you could look at is something which is a separate scheme for online businesses that was more based on sales. And we have this already. This is the point we always make. You already have separate schemes for petrol forecourts. Many of our listeners and our members will be, you know, will be paying business rates on that basis and probably don't like it very much. For pubs, for ATMs, which is obviously something we deal with in our sector. So I really think it's possible in the current system to have a separate scheme for online businesses that would address some of the challenges there. I'm not saying it'd be perfect. I mean, I'm sure there'd be legitimate concerns about that, but I think that'd be possible.
Yeah, and so finally, while I'd like to be here all afternoon going through all 100 pages of all the manifestos, we have to cut it down somewhere. So we'll finish with this. Was there anything in the manifestos that, I guess, surprised you by its inclusion, or even anything that you were pretty certain that would be in there somewhere and isn't? Or not? I mean, some of them were pretty comprehensive, so saying they're okay is okay.
Okay, so I'm going to say I called it pretty well, and there's nothing in there that surprised me too much. I suppose the one bit that I thought I might see a bit more, and which, don't get me wrong, there's a lot in there, is around this employment bit, around flexible working. We had a big, big, long debate around flexible working and two-sided flexibility in the workplace and good quality work. And actually, the Labour Party have got lots and lots in there. The Conservative Party have focused on it and said there will be a need for a commitment to flexible working, but not a legal commitment. There's not a commitment to legislation in that space. And that was the same thing that was in their Queen's speech, which was we will introduce these measures, but we won't introduce new legislation. And that seems like a slight change from narrative from the Theresa May administration to the Boris Johnson administration. So somewhat surprised and by that. But otherwise, I think the core bits that we were expecting were pretty clear.
Yeah.
I was interested by the shorter working week idea, not just
this
my own,
32-hour
just myself,
average
but,
working week.
This point. And I suppose from a couple of perspectives, thinking about our sector, because we're already very much based on part-time employment.
Yeah.
But something like that would also have huge implications, for example, for managers, for store managers. We are long hours we operate for, probably more longer than any other sector in terms of per site. But we are lots of part-time working, making up that with all our colleagues doing that. So I think the interaction with that and the sector is, and also the interaction with that and the idea of a living wage. What do I need to live on?
Yeah.
Those two things are potentially quite a challenge for us in terms of how we would fund that. But I think what it said to me is, and it's not the first time we've heard about this, but it said to me this isn't just about working legislation about wages. It's much broader about the way that work is changing at a very sort of strategic macro technological level in society at the moment. And one of the things we've got to do is think about, how do we fit in with that?
Yeah, one thing actually that surprised me by its lack of inclusion was, given that we are very close to the track and trace rules and all that sort of thing, I didn't see anything in there about, you know, increased border protection, increased checks on things like products, because we're going into potentially quite a big uncertain stage. So I don't think they're probably making enough of it. It's a £4 billion hole in the Treasury's coffers.
It's really interesting that you think before the referendum, so much talk about about borders, controlling our borders, and obviously free movement. This was the biggest single issue in the referendum, wasn't it? People were talking about. And I think now, the reality is, we'll be so concerned about anything that might make it harder to move product through and disruption and so on, that we might perversely see the opposite outcome, where things move through ports so easily that you don't have necessary checks on things like smuggling and obviously of people. I mean, obviously we've seen recently, but from our members' point of view, particularly thinking about the products that come through, they're often smuggled, and so it might perversely lead to our borders becoming less secure perhaps, and that concerns me.
Ed, you're going to tell me I had two pages stuck together now and there was a massive thing on this.
No, there's a small part of the Conservative Manifesto that talked about tackling the illicit trade on tobacco, so that's obviously positive and relates back to the tobacco track and trace, and there was a commitment around reviewing alcohol duties.
So
there were a few little nods to it, but again, you know, that was a common thread through that manifesto in particular, that let's be light on detail, don't overcommit, be cautious.
Well, while Conservatives may be light on detail, we hopefully haven't been. Thank you both for taking us through this, and if you're a retailer that's listening and undecided about who to vote for, perhaps this episode has given you a bit more of an idea of which direction to lean in. We're not going to ask you to go one way or another, you make up your own mind on that. We are, of course, now less than 2 weeks away from the election, but there is still time to get involved in the process by hosting a store visit with the candidates. And this is generally just a great thing to do, because it's an opportunity to raise local issues and get some pre-election commitments on the things that you and your local community care about. And let's be honest, right now, the balance of power is definitely with you, because there are a lot of constituencies that are very much up for grabs at the moment. If you'd like to arrange a store visit with a candidate, please contact Steve Dowling in our office at steve.dowling@acs.org.uk. And for everything else, including our summary of the manifestos, our manifestos at a glance document, keep up to date with that, and the rest of the ACS news online at ACS_local shops on social media and on our website at acs.org.uk.